overnight. Cloudy skies tonight. Lows in the upper 30s. Sunny skies tomorrow. Highs near 65. Northwest winds 5 to 10. For Friday, sunny. Highs near 64. It is time for As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Golden opportunity as Donald Trump trumpets plans for a Golden Dome missile defense system. A former Canadian Minister of National Defense tells us he hopes Canada can get in on the deal.
And the price is right. For the cost of a latte, a fancy one, but a latte, you can pay for a chance to own a country home in Ireland. That's because its owner decided to skip the standard real estate process and just sell her house by raffle. And she says the idea is gaining traction among sellers.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Doug Danger, your volunteer host for On the River. He'll have a great mix of music. We are so excited for tomorrow night, Kick It with KAXC. We're going to be at Rapids Brewing Company in Grand Rapids starting at 5:30. We'll have our annual meeting with a brief recap of the past year, and we'll meet potential new board members, and we have live music from Molly Mayer and Woodblind meets Tiga Lexi featuring TNT Hi-Fi, and we'll be celebrating our volunteers between the musical acts. This is all made possible with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Again, tomorrow night, starting at 5:30, Rapids Brewing Company. Right now, we're going to hear some music from Woodblind meets Tiga Lexi. This is a live version of 5 Foot.
This is The Set List on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at shows Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, May 22nd through the 24th, with music in Grand Rapids, Hibbing, Bemidji, and Crosby. First up, Kick It with KAXC is this Thursday, 5:30 at Rapids Brewing Co. in Grand Rapids, with music from Molly Mayer and Woodblind meets Tiga Lexi. Mayer is a key figure and longtime member of the Minnesota music scene, making bluesy and authentic Americana music. Her band, The Disbelievers, features top-notch musicians from the Minnesota scene, like guitarist Eric Koskinen. Woodblind meets Tiga Lexi is a recent collaboration between two Duluth groups, pairing the songwriting of Alexi with the authentic Jamaican sounds of Woodblind. That's this Thursday, 5:30 at Rapids Brewing for Kick It with KAXE. In Hibbing, Greg Taberzi and Paul Seba are hosting a Dylan tribute show Friday at 7 p.m. and Saturday at 3:30 p.m. Both shows are at Boomtown and are in honor of Bob Dylan's birthday this Saturday, May 24th. Another Friday night show is Wayward at Bridget's in Bemidji, this one at 8 p.m. Jonathan Edwards is an indie pop singer from Minneapolis with one album, Happiness, released so far. Friday, 8 p.m. at Bridget's. Then on Saturday, Aurora Bear is playing the Canna Wine Bar in Crosby at 5 p.m. A folk singer-songwriter with a background in punk and alt-rock, Bear's songs showcase her honest and gritty writing style. That's 5 o'clock Saturday in Crosby. Do you have information on live music you'd like us to know about? Email comments at kaxc.org. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Dome luck. Donald Trump has big plans for the Golden Dome, and he says Canada wants in. Former Defense Minister David Pratt tells us it actually is, in his view, about time Canada made a move on missile defense.
Pedal to the metal. Canada has never had a successful domestic car company of its own, but one industry leader says it's past time to take the idea for a test drive.
Peaking too early, climbers summited Everest today using a new method that allowed them to do it in a matter of days instead of the usual weeks. A veteran mountaineer tells us the challenge is the point.
Fiction is stranger than truth. The Chicago Sun-Times is called out for a summer reading list that includes novels that don't exist, generated, it may not surprise you, by AI.
Cottage industry. A woman looking to sell her country home in Ireland tells us why she decided to go the raffle route, in which the winner gets that home and the acres around it for an investment of just about $9.
And all that glitters is definitely not gold. Water voles are endangered in Wales, but by feeding them sparkles so they poop out sparkles, scientists see a glimmer of hope. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that assures you the sparkles are safe, so it's no harm done. When he returned to office in January, U.S. President Donald Trump promised a brand new missile defense program. And now he's got a name for it. Yesterday afternoon, President Trump announced plans for the Golden Dome defense system, a multi-billion dollar project he says will protect the country by shooting down missiles. And he says he's not the only one interested in it.
Canada has called us and they want to be a part of it. So we'll be talking to them. They want to have protection also. So, as usual, we help Canada do the best we can.
U.S. President Donald Trump in the Oval Office yesterday. Shortly after that announcement, Prime Minister Mark Carney's office confirmed that the federal government is in talks with the U.S. about participating in the system. It's not the first time Canada has weighed such a collaboration. In 2005, Liberal Prime Minister Paul Martin declined to participate in the U.S. missile defense program. At the time, David Pratt was his Minister of National Defense. Now he's a defense consultant for several companies, none of which are currently involved in the Golden Dome plans. We reached David Pratt in Ottawa.
David Pratt, in declining, Paul Martin, the Prime Minister at the time, said that the government would make the decision when it is in Canada's interest to do so. It appears at this stage that Prime Minister Carney is interested. Is it in Canada's interest now?
I believe it certainly is. I think this has been a sore point in terms of relations between Canada and the U.S. for a number of years, that we haven't been part of missile defense. And I think it's the right thing for Prime Minister Carney to be talking to the Americans about this and getting information and understanding what's being contemplated, what the potential costs are, what Canada's responsibilities might be. So I think it's high time we move forward on this.
Canada has been participating in NORAD, as you well know, since 1958. As our colleague Alex Panetta wrote in his online piece too, the refusal 20 years ago meant that Canada can monitor the skies but not participate in decisions about when to launch a potential strike if there were, you know, if there was an incoming threat. I know we're still waiting for so many details about what this Golden Dome would be able to do, but what's your sense of what it would allow us to do if we took part that we don't with NORAD already?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think what President Trump has talked about is very, very ambitious in terms of the capability of this system. And I'm not sure, frankly, that the Americans can afford it in the first place. But I think part of, you know, the reason why the Prime Minister and the government might be interested in talking to the Americans about this is to really find out, you know, what is being contemplated. Because, you know, we've been out of the loop in terms of interception and the interdiction of missiles since 2005. And it's resulted in a disjointed command structure for NORAD. And so I think it's time to correct this.
In terms of timing and Canada's interests, given what we've been experiencing with this administration in the United States, the state of the relationship between our two countries, yes, it may be getting on better footing since Prime Minister Carney's face-to-face with Donald Trump not so long ago, but is this the right time for this kind of partnership?
Well, I don't think we have much choice in terms of the timing. Certainly, President Trump has said a lot of things that cause a lot of concern and even anger amongst Canadians. But I think we have to keep in mind as well that the relationship with the defense relationship with the United States dates back before the Second World War. And whatever we agree to will presumably be in place for many, many years to come. So, as I say, I think the government's doing the right thing in terms of engaging in these negotiations. And I think we have to take the Americans, we have to deal with them in good faith.
If you were part of the government, or if you were Minister of National Defense right now, what would be on your list? What should Canada be asking for, in your view, or advocating for, making sure it gets if it does sign on to something like this, to make sure we are getting a good deal? Because it might be hard for people to get their minds around trusting the U.S. administration at this stage?
Yeah, well, when I was a Minister of National Defense in 2004, we got to the point of I sent a letter to Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and just simply saying, we want to talk. And I think that's what's necessary at this point to understand what the Americans have contemplated, making sure that we are a full partner and that we have responsibility for our own sovereignty is tremendously important here, that we're not, you know, undermining our own role in terms of the protection of Canada and the defense of Canadian citizens.
China, perhaps not surprisingly, has weighed in saying it is, quote, seriously concerned about this plan, saying that it would create a space arms race and hurt the global strategic balance. Are those questions that are in your mind? Should Canada be concerned about those things?
Well, you know, Canada has taken a role in terms of arms control going back many, many years. And what we've seen as well is, and this was plain in 2004, this was plain in 20 years ago as well, that the threats were evolving. Even back in 2004, the North Koreans were developing new missiles. The Iranians were developing new missiles. The Russians, you know, back at the time, they had, you know, significant missile technology as well, and the Chinese were catching up. We're in a situation now where we have to deal with the threats that are out there now. It's really debatable as to whether or not this is going to upset any kind of strategic balance, because I think it's all about keeping up with the current threats and, you know, protecting the continent under those circumstances.
Last month, you and another former defense minister, conservative Peter McKay, wrote a piece in the National Post, an opinion piece, both of you advocating for more defense spending, saying it needed to be a focus for Mark Carney's government. Is this exactly the kind of thing you had in mind?
Well, You know, I think what we were suggesting as well was a foreign and defense policy review, which I think is tremendously important. And I'm hoping that the new government will look at that, because I think the previous policy that we had in place, strong, secure, and engaged, has become somewhat irrelevant. You know, if the U.S. is backing away from NATO, then Canada's, you know, likely going to have to step up. And what that means for Canadian defense spending is probably significant in terms of boosting our budget. So an integrated air and missile defense system will probably, you know, certainly come up. I think it has to be dealt with, you know, as part of a series of priorities that the Defense Department has.
David Pratt, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Pratt is a former Minister of National Defence of Canada. We reached him in Ottawa. We requested an interview with the current Minister of Defence, David McGuinty, but we have not heard back. Mountaineers call it the death zone, an altitude above 8,000 meters where there's far less available oxygen than at sea level. Reaching the death zone on Mount Everest usually takes weeks of acclimatization, a long and dangerous process of partial runs up and down from base camp before moving on to climb to the summit. But this morning, a team made it to the summit without stopping to adjust themselves to the atmosphere, using a brand new technique. And they did it in just 5 days, thanks to a process that simulates high-altitude oxygen levels by exposing the climbers to xenon gas in specially made sleeping tents long before the actual climb. The method is the brainchild of Lucas Furtenbach, who is an experienced and respected Everest guide, but it's still dividing the climbing community. Alan Arnett has climbed Everest 4 times and climbed to altitudes over 6,000 meters more than a dozen times. He documents Everest news on his website, alanarnett.com. We reached him in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Alan, the fact that these climbers made it to the summit this morning without acclimatizing in the usual way, did you see that coming? Were you surprised by it?
You know, I think there's been a trend for a long time to shorten the summits of Everest. You know, traditionally it took April and May, about 2 months to climb it, 8 weeks. When I summited in 2011, that was my schedule. And slowly but surely, they've cut time off using different techniques, including now xenon.
You have done this, as you've said. You've climbed these heights. When you're first acclimatizing to being at those altitudes without the aid of something like xenon, what does it feel like?
It hurts. It's a sucker fest.
I bet.
It's like climbing a set of stairs and holding your breath for 9 out of 10 steps. The breathing is very difficult. You know, it's a process. It's difficult.
Why do you like this kind of suffering, Alan?
You know, I get that question a lot, and I had a hard time answering it for a long time. Yeah. But eventually, after 38 major expeditions around the world, what I realized was that every time I went through this process, I came home a better version of myself. Mm-hmm. And I hope that better version allows me to be a more positive contributor to humanity.
This version of the climb using xenon's help, how are folks in the climbing community reacting to this?
You know, it's mixed. You know, there's always the purist in any community, whether it's in, you know, sailing or marathons or whatever it is, that is against any type of aid. And climbing is no different. There are people that criticize people like me for going on a commercial expedition using supplemental oxygen, using a Sherpa, or even using boots. But then there's others that are like me that say, you know, this is a sport that has no rules. There's no trophies. There's no rewards. It's really an individual endeavor. And so if someone wants to use xenon or helium or whatever they want to use, who am I to judge them?
Do you think, based on what you know, that this really does have the potential to change how people climb Everest?
You know, I think the clear answer is that we don't know. There were many factors that went into this climb. First off, these guys were all ex-military UK Gurkhas. They were in outstanding, amazing physical shape. They had slept with in these hypoxic tents for 2 months before they went. They used supplemental oxygen. So, you know, there was a lot they did to help them make this work. Now, whether they could have done it with or without Xenon, I don't know.
Yeah, they also paid a lot of money.
Yeah, they paid $150,000 to climb it, yeah. And so, you know, in the median price this year, 2025, is about $45,000. So, you know, it's three times as much.
The organizer has suggested that cutting out the longer acclimatization period could ultimately make this kind of adventure safer by eliminating the need to climb up and down to base camp to prepare for summiting in the end. What do you make of that? Do you think this could be safer in the long run?
Absolutely. You know, anytime you spend less time on a mountain, then you reduce the risk of objective danger of, you know, rockfall and avalanches and getting sick. So the shorter is the better. But I think that misses the point. For me and for many other people, going on a big climb like an Everest or a K2 is all about the experience. It's about the journey. It's about the suffering that you do that I mentioned earlier that allows me to come home a better version of myself. So, you know, I understand the safety argument, but for me, it's all about the journey, and it's not about just bagging a summit and coming back home quickly.
And then there's the environmental aspect, the crowding that we've reported on in the past, in addition to what we talked about. I wonder as well if there's a worry, if you're worried or others that you've spoken to, that those who have that kind of money and that desire for adventure, less so a desire for the suffering that you and others feel should come with this kind of trek, that it might actually lead to people thinking there are shortcuts and it could have horrible consequences in the end, that people who aren't prepared really to do this are going to try to.
You know, the American mountaineer Ed Viesters, who became the only American to summit all 14 of the 8,000-meter mountains without using supplemental oxygen, coined a phrase, there's no shortcuts to the top. You know, and so I think that goes to the heart of this, that certainly there's a risk that, you know, this type of publicity from the guy who did it in 3 days or the team that did it in 5 days, that people will say, okay, now I can go climb it the same way I climbed Mont Blanc or, you know, any other mountain around the world in a short period of time. The difference is that at 29,000 feet, I mean, that altitude, that's where airplanes fly. So, you know, it's not that everybody can go climb these things, and not everybody's going to have access to doing xenon. First off, it's, you know, if it's used improperly, it can be a dangerous gas, even though it's used for an anesthesia. But under doctor's supervision, as this team has shown, that is an effective way. Now, whether that's what was the factor that caused them to climb, as I said earlier, I'm not really sure. But I think there's a risk that people will take any type of a way to have a shortcut, all the way from, you know, using supplemental oxygen to, you know, pre-acclimatizing to using these, you know, these other aids. They're gonna jump to the conclusion that, oh, I can do it too, and that may be a deadly mistake.
You've done it the quote-unquote right way, the way you believe it should be done in the past, reaching the summit. Would you, you know, for research purposes or understand where the industry is going or the community is going, would you try xenon gas and give it a shot this way?
No, absolutely not. You know, I don't think that, I really believe that it's an experience that should be taken slowly and savored and not to be rushed. I think you missed the whole benefit of going to a different country, enjoying the culture, learning about new people, learning about yourself, bonding with your teammates and those other people that are climbing with you, and enjoying the, you know, the benefits of you know, really suffering and going through this. Now, I know that sounds strange, but to me, that's all part of the expedition. And cutting it short, I think it misses the point. I'm just not a fan.
A pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for this, Alan.
Sure thing. Thank you. Appreciate the call.
We reached mountaineer Alan Arnett in Fort Collins, Colorado. Trying to buy a house can feel a lot like trying to win a lottery, which, as anyone who has tried to win a lottery knows, it doesn't usually work that well. You finally find a place that you both like and can afford, and then someone else buys it. That happens repeatedly. Then you start bidding on places that you don't like and can't afford, only to lose them to other people in the same boat. Sometimes it feels like the lottery actually has better odds. Well, a woman in Ireland has decided to make the sale of her home an actual lottery. She's asking people from all over the world to enter a raffle for the chance to win the cottage located in the Irish countryside, and there are only a few hours left to go. We reached Imelda Collins in that home near Sligo, Ireland.
Not long now, Imelda. Tomorrow, the winning ticket is going to be drawn. How many tickets have you sold so far?
Since my raffle was featured in the New York Times yesterday, my ticket sales have soared, so I am very, very, very near to my goal.
What is your goal?
So my goal is 150,000 tickets.
Well, that would be... And so I was going to ask if you know, based on what you paid for it and the upgrades you made, whether this was a risk that you might not make back the money that you spent on this house.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You invest money in it and you've no idea what you're going to make back or how many tickets are going to sell. So it was a risk.
Why did you want to take that? You could have called up a realtor, right, near Sligo and asked them to put it on the market.
That's it. That would have been a lot easier.
Maybe a little less fun.
But the raffle idea came from an article that I read online about a lady living in Dublin who was moving to Paris and she decided to raffle her apartment. She also mentioned, you know, that it would be nice to give somebody an apartment in Dublin for the price of a coffee or whatever way she put it. And of course, if my raffle is successful, in the end, I would hope to make more money than had I sold it on the open market.
Yeah.
But again, no guarantees. I could have ended up losing money, you know, but I won't know anyway until tomorrow, until it's all over.
Yeah. And is there a minimum number of tickets that have to be sold, right? If it doesn't hit that minimum, then the winner just gets some of the money, right? Not the property.
Yeah. So if it doesn't hit the minimum, which is 150,000 tickets, the winner gets 50% of the ticket proceeds. Raphael gets their 10% commission and I get the rest and I keep my house. And of course, if I reach my target, the winner gets the home.
Yeah.
If I get close to my target, I may decide, do you know what? I'm very close to the 150,000. I'll give the house anyway. So there's kind of three scenarios.
A ticket, it costs about $9. How did you decide on that price?
So I looked at previous raffles and £5 was actually the figure that Raphael encouraged me to go with because they said everybody can afford £5.
You call this place Butterfly Cottage, which sounds beautiful. And the photos are quite lovely as well. Can you describe what it's like?
It's very, very colourful. There's a nature theme throughout the cottage, you know, from the wallpaper, the curtains, you know, the bedding, everything.
And you're including all the furniture. As well. Why did you decide to do that?
Because I just thought for the winner, it would be just nice for them to get, you know, everything. They can step into a new home. I will pay their legal fees. I'll pay their stamp duty. They won't have to pay anything and they won't have to purchase anything because everything is there.
Is it hard to sell a house in Ireland? I mean, you know, why do you think people are going this route?
So I suppose it's just an alternative way of, like I mentioned, I will hopefully make some money out of it. I should do if it succeeds. You know, maybe somebody is interested in trying a different way of selling a home. So it has become quite popular here in Ireland. Yeah.
And how long have you lived in Butterfly Cottage?
I moved in November 22, so what's that, over two years now?
Almost 3 years.
2.5 years.
And you put a lot of work into it and love?
A huge amount. Like, when I purchased it, it needed gutting, it needed a complete renovation. So I did that and then complete redecoration as well.
Was it always the goal to live in for a bit, fix it up and sell it or flip it as people might say?
No, it wasn't actually. So my story is that I used to live in Italy. My husband is there. And of course, as you can imagine, him being from Italy, me being from Ireland, you know, you're kind of, will we live there? Will we live here? Sure. Over the years, we lived in both countries. And it was, I suppose, the plan perhaps to move back permanently to Ireland. But you just, I've realized you can't really make long-term plans anyway, you know. True. So my home is in Italy. I love Italy. And as I say, I've got family there, my husband and his family.
What do they think about this strategy?
Well, initially, my husband was like, he thought I was crazy, to be quite honest. So I convinced him, because it's unheard of really in Italy, sure. Perhaps in Canada and America it's unheard of as well, mm-hmm. but it's not unheard of here. So I assured him I'd done all the research. I wasn't jumping into it. I brought him around after a while, so he's delighted now with it.
I bet. You're, especially as he hears about the ticket sales.
I know, yeah.
Is it going to be hard to leave though, Imelda, even though you did all the research, you were ready, but still hard in the end?
It will. It'll be very hard. There last week, I was waiting for some swallows to build a nest on my gable wall. They started one day and I was so excited, and they haven't completed it. So I don't know what they're up to. Oh. But I see rabbits sometimes in the garden. I actually have like a robin that eats from my hand. So I've had some really special experiences with nature that I haven't had for years. So yeah, it'll be hard to leave because I love nature so much. I keep repeating that, but
I can see that. Yeah, you can see how beautiful it is. So I can understand that. What's your dream winner? Who is your dream winner?
Well, the dream winner would be somebody that can't afford a house, or somebody that is struggling to get on the property ladder, which I'm sure a lot of people are. So really, it would be lovely for somebody who can't afford a home to win.
A pleasure speaking with you, Imelda. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Imelda Collins is raffling off her cottage in Ireland. We reached her there near Sligo. The sound of a hungry water vole nibbling vegetation. The sound of an angry water vole squeaking. And the sound of a regular water vole's feces sparkling. Regular had two meanings there. Now, the nibbling and squeaking, water voles just make those sounds naturally, but water voles' droppings only sparkle in an emergency, which this is. Water voles could once be found nibbling and squeaking along waterways all over Wales. Now they're all but extinct in all but a handful of places because of what one scientist calls a perfect storm of bad things, including drained wetlands and invasive predators. It's tough for conservationists to even know where the remaining water voles are because they're reclusive, and that is where the glitter comes in. Well, where the glitter comes in is the voles' mouths, and it comes out in the form of glittery poop, which will let conservationists see where they've been. And if scientists use different colors of glitter for different families of voles, the poop will give them a much fuller picture of the voles' habitat and range, which in turn will help them understand what environmental changes need to be made to allow the creatures to thrive. Now, the glitter, I will mention, is both edible and biodegradable, and it will add a touch of the fabulous to both water vole poop and water vole research. And if it works, well, what a dazzling achievement. Here are Keys and Crates featuring Ombre Perkins with Glitter. Featuring Ombre Perkins with Glitter.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, reinventing the wheels, an auto industry leader says now is the time for an all-Canadian car company. Past efforts may have sputtered, but he says now we have all the parts to make it work.
And read 'em and weep. We'll hear from the woman who exposed the Chicago Sun-Times' use of AI in a recent summer reading list that featured real authors but unreal books.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
We shine, we shine, we shine.
Thanks for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. At 7 o'clock, Doug Danger, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music and more great music at 10 o'clock, Headwaters. Tag team today, Kari Hedlund and DJ Dang on that. Support for KAXC comes from Beltrami County Historical Society, offering 6 days of real talk about periods during Menstruation Health Week, May 26th through the 31st, with a special museum exhibit, documentary screenings, author talks, and a community period product drive. Details at beltramihistory.org/period. We also thank Bemidji Brewing, offering rotating taproom exclusive beers and crawlers to go. The latest offerings available Tuesday through Thursday, 2 to 9, Friday and Saturday, 11 to 10, Sunday, 11 to 6. More at bemidjibeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Thanks for choosing KAXE this evening. We continue now with As It Happens.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the Wednesday edition, part 2. The Manic GT looks like something James Bond would have driven. Not the Daniel Craig James Bond. Definitely the Roger Moore James Bond. The sleek little sports car was made in Quebec about 50 years ago. The Bricklin SV1, made in New Brunswick in the 70s, had more of a space-age vibe, with doors that opened up like gull wings. Now, you've probably never heard of either of these Canadian-made cars. That's because they were not successful. But in the midst of the trade war with the U.S., Flavio Volpe thinks it's time for Canada to take another look at having an automaker of its very own. Mr. Volpe is the president of the Automotive Parts Manufacturing Association, which represents Canadian companies that supply components to international automakers. We reached him in Toronto.
Flavio, you certainly know Canada's track record with this issue. Were you bracing, given that, for people to roll their eyes or even laugh at you when you brought this idea up?
Well, look, I mean, we have a lot of national traditions, and one is to be really comfortable in our successes and not try the types of things that, you know, define big league countries. There have been attempts in the past to do this that have failed, but certainly they haven't been in today's era, where Canada is a superpower in parts manufacture, in tooling, in the critical minerals that power electrification of vehicles, but also in all that connectivity technology, the AI, the machine learning that makes the electrified cars of the future. Those are all Canadian strengths. And I think we should learn from the past. We should learn why those things failed. But we should also learn from those great dreamers and entrepreneurs that said, in the failing, there is something that we add to the national zeitgeist, to the ambition, and to defining to the next generation just how hard they should strive as we build this country.
We're in a different position, you're saying. We have different know-how, different skills, and it's a different time in history. I hear what you're saying on that front. You spoke to the Globe and Mail as well, and they spoke to others who have some different thoughts. Dennis Darby, the Canadian Manufacturers and Exporters, told the paper, quote, "The devil will be in the details." McMaster University's Greg Mordew, who used to work as an executive at Toyota Canada, told the paper, quote, "It's just not practical." So there are others who feel this way. Do you understand that skepticism and where they're coming from?
Sure. You know, frankly, I think it's healthy debate. And what Dennis said is the same things that we say. I didn't say, let's start a car company. I said, we should do the hard work to do the feasibility study, to understand if we can do that sustainably in a way that creates a cluster. And I think I agree exactly with what Dennis said. The devil is in the details. And Greg is a gentleman. You know, we worked together when he was on the opposite of the table at Toyota. But I prefer to try to do something more ambitious than what we've done in the past. What we've done in the past has also left us vulnerable in a position when the world shifts because the president of the United States has a cold. I'm not offended by skepticism or criticism. I think that there are smarter people than all of us that should take a good look at this and give it a run.
Are there interested parties so far as you've been having these conversations?
Well, we launched Project Aero, a demonstration all-Canadian vehicle prototype 2 years ago, and it's been touring the world. In that program, we've had interested parties, Canadian parties and global parties, who wanted to put capital at risk to launch a car company. And I said then to them, that vehicle's for demonstration. That is not for series production. Mm-hmm. But it has always been one of the projects that we wanted to pursue after to say, look, what if we started with a look at something that you could do for series production that could fill a gap. There are lots of interested parties. The reaction to this today has been extraordinary. This is probably my 20th interview. I was just on stage at the Canadian Club in Toronto. What people have been saying today is, you're absolutely right about the national ambition. Let's try something different. Let's leave something for our children and our grandchildren, even if it's just the legacy of not being afraid to put ourselves out there in a world where the definition of the big leagues are changing. Mexico and Mexico's president has launched a car company called Alinea. Turkey and Vietnam. Canada is in a second tier of those countries today in automaking. And that's just not the Canada that I'm satisfied with.
So as difficult as the uncertainty from the tariff threats and tariff realities coming from the United States have been, was there a part of you that, given what you've been doing with Project Aero, that was excited, if that's the right word, that there's, you know, seeing an opportunity there after all this time?
Well, look, Project Aero is a industrial collaboration. Nobody owns it other than us, and it's not a commercial venture. I'll say that things we learned on Project Aero was that everything in a vehicle can be made by Canadians in Canada. Now, that doesn't make it commercially viable. You know, you have to make sure that you build something for profit. But it has drawn out a lot of dreamers for us in everything from the AI space to the critical mineral space. And I think it would be a shame for all of these people who are expressing a very strong intent to be part of something bigger and to move Canada's interests forward, that we've all spent the last few months really defending Canada, then if all I can contribute to this is all of the political equity I have to say, let's give this really strong consideration and let's see who are the experts in the disciplines that we need here to make a go of it. You know, then I'm very excited to be all in. And there is a groundswell of people who are very excited to give this a very serious look.
We've been speaking with auto workers and automakers throughout this tariff uncertainty. They've said, you know, that the market here is not huge in Canada. I think fewer than 2 million vehicles are sold each year in Canada. So in terms of the market for a Canadian vehicle in the future, what do you see on that front?
Well, there's automakers that make 10 million cars a year, like Toyota and Volkswagen. There are car companies that make 11,000 a year, like Ferrari. The volume to get market share in a 2 million vehicle market and then also to build for export. If you have the right product, you can build a profitable company at much lower volumes than the biggest car makers do. Every car maker starts with their first car and their first plant. 10 years ago, I sat at a forum in Detroit where a young upstart named Elon Musk said, well, we made 50,000 cars this year. We think in the next 5 years, we'll make 500,000 cars that year. And everybody laughed at him. And this year, Tesla, which didn't exist in 2008, will make 2.5 million cars. And it's the most valuable car company in the world.
Flavio Volpe, I appreciate your time as always. Thank you.
Anytime, Neil. Thank you for having me.
Flavio Volpe is the president of the Automotive Parts Manufacturing Association. He's in Toronto. It started out as a leisurely stroll along the grounds of a former St. John's golf course. It ended in a dramatic rescue operation. Last week, retired CBC Newfoundland and Labrador reporter Glenn Payette was on a walk with his wife when they heard noises coming from somewhere nearby.
My wife went, "Who's making that racket?" And suddenly I went, "That sounds like somebody might be calling their dog." And a moment later, I realized, and I said to my wife, "That's somebody calling help or help me." And as soon as we heard that, we made a beeline for the voice, then saw him, picked up the pace, and he was in the pond on his back. And it was clear immediately that he was exhausted. He was spent. I yelled out, "You were here. We're going to get you out. Don't worry." He was about 12 feet from shore, I'd say. And there was no way I could reach him. So I looked around for a stick. I lay down on my belly and I asked my wife to, you know, hold my legs. She did. I reached out with it and got it out to him. He was able to grab it. And of course, he was still up, but he had been rolling on his side. His face was in the water, but he had enough strength to grab it. I was able to gingerly pull him in. And when I got him close enough, I was able to reach down, grab his arm and his jacket and pull him up and got him up. Once I got to that point, then I yelled to my wife, "Call 911. So once I knew he was safe and things were more secure, his dog was in the pond, and that's how he ended up in the pond, because the dog went in because there was a dead dog already in the pond, and the dog had gone in after it, and he went to try and get his own dog off, stepped on the edge on the rubber, and slipped in. And luckily, another man came by who also had a dog. I said, "Come give me a hand and we'll pull him up further." So we were able to, between the two of us, pull him up and get him up so that his bum was now on the ground and he was safe. And around the same time, the fire department and the police started to arrive. A couple of police officers went into the pond and slipped on the rubber lining, where luckily were able to get back on their feet. And at one point, they were trying to put a leash back on his dog. And when they did it, they pulled and the collar came right off the dog's head. So then they had to try it again and they got the collar back on. This time when they pulled, it stayed on and he was able to give the dog a shove and they got it up over the bank. They got the dog up, put him in one of their vehicles. They took him, put him in one of his vehicles and checked him out. And luckily he was fine. We talked to him about how he's feeling. He's doing well. And no, he seems to be fine.
Glenn Payette is a retired CBC reporter in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador. If you're a book lover, the release of a summer reading list is reason for you to get out your highlighter and get excited. It's generally an opportunity to learn about novels to look forward to, except when you discover the fiction list is itself fiction. Recently, podcaster and self-proclaimed booktuber Tina Simmons took a closer look at a list that the Chicago Sun-Times published. She recognized the names of the authors, but she didn't recognize the names of their upcoming books. And it turned out that was because they don't exist. So she outed the paper for using AI to generate the list. We reached her in Chicago, Illinois.
Tina, so you and many others see this summer reading list pop up. Is that something that usually gets you excited?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I am a big... One of my things I always say is I'm obsessed with new books. I just love book lists. I want to see what's coming out. And when this came to my attention, a friend sent me a photo of the list from the paper. And I thought immediately, because I pay such close attention to books, that at least half of the titles were fake. I saw Andy Weir listed and I saw a title that I didn't know. And I'm like, oh, maybe he has a new book coming out, because that would be great. But then quickly I realized not only were some of them hallucinated, some of them were corrected to wrong authors, like the one that said Migration. So quickly I realized, oh, this is not good.
Yeah, you see the names of the authors, Isabel Allende, just at the top of the list. But what were some of the titles that you saw and thought, there is no way?
Yeah, no. Well, for The one sort of like right in the beginning, Isabel Allende, I did not know about that one. But then I saw The Last Algorithm by Andy Weir. And that was my big tip off, because I thought, if I know Andy Weir, I feel like that is a very anti sort of title, right, that he would write. And then I kept reading and I'm like, oh, my goodness. I know these authors. I know their work. Migrations by Charlotte McConaghy is one of my all-time favorite books. And it's listed here, Maggie O'Farrell. And I'm like, oh, no, this is all wrong. And so I sort of went through methodically to figure out. I'm like, some of these are just made up. And then some of them, you know, have the wrong author credited, like Hurricane Season is Fernanda Melcher, not Britt Bennett. And, you know, I sort of figured it from there.
You don't want to make a book lover angry. You don't want to upset them, obviously, let alone with a huge audience online. So you took a picture and posted it of you holding up this page from the actual newspaper. And you started hearing from people, including authors, really quickly, right?
Exactly. And so what I did, I had this photo initially, it was just the picture on a desk. And one person said, hey, how do we know this photo is real? And I'm like, no, you know what I am. I'm going to go cite my sources. I took myself to the library, took that paper out and like wanted to get a picture of with me in it, with the date on my wristwatch or, you know, my Apple Watch, just so that folks could say, oh, OK, this is a real thing. I just didn't want people to question the authenticity of it. Right. And we should be questioning things that we see online. Is this real? Was it really in the paper? And it was. And that's once I posted that photo with me holding the newspaper in the library, I'm like, oh, no. It was exciting because I'm like, I know, like you said, readers are going to get upset by this, but also the authors. That's when things really got blown up, is when some of the authors started writing their response pieces. And I'm like, oh, this is a big thing.
And what did they say?
Not only authors, they were some of my very favorite authors. Mm. Like I saw Chuck Wendig responded, and basically he was like, is this real? And so I think to his it was on Blue Sky. To his post, I responded, yes, it is. And here's the photo of me holding up this paper, you know, and I had to like break it to one of my favorite authors that indeed this sloppy AI generated list was real. And basically they just called into question the integrity of the paper, but also just readership in general and why AI usage as it pertains to books and reading is such a problem, and how their books are getting fed into these generative AI, and just down the line, how bad this can be overall.
The newspaper has said that this was made externally, that members of the newsroom did not know, and they're not sure how it made it that far to the point of publication, because even if something is in an advertised section or a special section that's not the journalistic section, it does is supposed to go through a review. What is your understanding at this point of how this all went down, how it did get to that point?
Yeah, so I understand that they sort of hired this third-party company to create this insert. And to be fair, it was an insert. It was not, and I didn't make that clear in my initial post. It wasn't like in the Times. It was an insert in the Times. However, it still has their name right at the top with the date. And to me, they're responsible for it. It's their name is on it. They have to have accountability. But they, from what I understand, they hired a third party company that does this sort of insert, and they had a person, I guess, at the company create this list. It was a 60-page insert, and then it looks like this other website contacted and found out who wrote it, because his name was on some of the other pieces, but not on this specific summer reading list. And then they contacted him, and he admitted to feeding it through AI and said that he typically does check his work and edit it, but it slipped his mind in this case. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, it slipped his mind. He also apologized, but what did you make of that apology?
I imagine he's having a very bad time right now. I think he is, you know, I think he's one person that did this thing that is really, really bad. And, you know, rightfully so. I'm imagining he's having, you know, repercussions from that. I just think, in general, this is a bad thing for all of us. You know, I think he's presumably paid to make this list, who fed it through this thing and thought, yeah, good enough. There are so many booksellers, podcasters, content creators, librarians, et cetera, that would have loved to create this guide. And book people, we don't cost that much. So you could have definitely paid somebody to create a very authentic and diverse, robust list. And instead, he just slept on it. And this is the fallout.
And publishers as well release lists. So even if someone wasn't going to do this is not a journalistic endeavor. Still not great. You should still talk to people and maybe read the books before you recommend them. But what do you think ultimately needs to change?
Yeah, I just think, I mean, there has to be accountability, right? I do understand AI is here to stay. And I'm using AI very broadly. You know, I think generative AI is the problem here. It's the thing that has hallucinated these titles, so to speak. Usage of generative AI just sort of robs us from the ability to be creative. Like, this is fun. I would have loved to have made a list like this. And like you said, the resources are everywhere. You know, people who love books would have easily been able to get this, but this person robbed us book lovers of, you know, getting that ability to create something like this.
Tina, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate this.
Tina Simmons is a book lover and podcaster in Chicago. Brendan Liao's recent Instagram post starts out, quote, "Well, I did a thing. The thing, really," unquote. And for him, the thing, his lifelong dream, was to be on Jeopardy. Not only did his episode air last night, but he won. In that post, Mr. Liao continued, "Am I using too many exclamation marks? Yeah!" With three exclamation marks, if you were wondering. "But you may never see me this excited ever again." If his passion for Jeopardy isn't clear yet, here is Brendan Liao talking to the CBC this morning about being on the show.
To be totally honest, it still feels kind of not real. The past, 2 months, I've just been texting. My dad was in the audience and a couple of friends, and I've just been texting them every couple of weeks being like, "Hey, I did that, right? Like, I didn't just hallucinate being on stage, and I'm not going to watch the episode yesterday and see three strangers and not me."
And not you there. That's weird. Yeah, I could see having kind of an out-of-body experience while that was going on.
Oh, yeah. I watching it yesterday, I was like, oh, wow, I do not remember most of what happened.
How did you prepare?
How did I prepare? I would say it's pretty much been like a lifelong thing of, you know, paying attention to the news and things that you read and paying attention in classes. But when I got the call, I obviously went into study mode and lots of flashcards and practicing on the buzzer. So just trying to get those things up to standard for the show.
And when did you start watching it?
Definitely around 8, 9 was probably when the first time I started watching. And I think pretty early on I realized I know quite a few of these things and it feels good to know things.
8 or 9.
Yeah, 8 or 9. And so it kind of just ballooned into a dream.
Yeah.
I did Reach for the Top in high school, which Alex Trebek hosted briefly. So that also helped.
Wow. How hard is it to perform on stage when you're competing against these other, you know, super smart people and you're there behind the podium and the questions start getting fired at you?
You don't really have time to even be nervous, I guess. You just have to go out and play. You don't find out when you're playing until 5 minutes before. they don't draw names until 5 minutes before you're going up on stage. It is hard. I don't know if you watched yesterday's game, but it was a bit of a nail biter. It wasn't looking good for me at the half. But I was lucky with the categories in the second round and managed to rebound and get the win.
And the episode, of course, was taped earlier this year. And you've had to keep all of this a secret until now.
Yes, hence the feeling this is surreal, because it's, you know, you can't say anything about it, and it's only, I don't know, 20 other people know that you did it for 2 months, and you're was this just a prank?
Jeopardy contestant and UBC grad Brendan Liao talking to CBC host Stephen Quinn on the early edition in Vancouver this morning.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
This is 91.7 KAX.